From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Orin Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for West Wing Reports. Our moderator is the Washington bureau chief for The Economist, David Rennie.
Good day, everyone, and the issues this week. World powers were divided by a chemical weapons attack by Syria's government against its own people, with America, Britain and France favouring retaliation, but Russia, Syria's ally, fiercely opposed. Senior Republicans and Democrats in Congress warned Donald Trump that he could destroy his presidency if he seeks the firing of Robert Mueller, the special counsel. But Mr. Trump was outraged by an FBI raid on his own private lawyer. In Congress, Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives and a one-time critic of Donald Trump, announced his retirement. And Mark Zuckerberg, the billionaire founder of Facebook, faced a hostile Congress for 2 days of hearings and faced calls for more regulation of social media firms. So, panel, we're in this strange moment. Here in Washington, we think there may be some military action against the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad for the chemical weapons attack. But as at the moment of this recording, we don't know exactly what's going to happen. But tell us, Paul Brandis, what has been Donald Trump's response to this chemical weapons attack in terms of setting red lines and enforcing red lines? How coherent has his response been so far?
Well, in general, it's been somewhat wishy-washy. And just to go back in time a little bit, as a candidate, Mr. Trump said that he would not be like Barack Obama, who he said always telegraphed his moves ahead of time. I'm going to do X at Y time frame and so forth. But this week, in fact, he tweeted his favorite platform. Well, watch out. These missiles are coming. It's going to be big and neat and beautiful, or words to that effect. And yesterday he kind of walked that back a little bit. So it's hard to figure out exactly what he really intends to do. He's been talking with his national security advisors over the past couple of days. Apparently, they are getting things quite coordinated with the French and the British and so forth. So we'll wait and see it. But in general, he has not been particularly consistent in talking about what he wants to do.
So, Orin Durrell, there's a lot to unpack here, isn't there? So let's take a step back. You have a red line that lots of world powers believe should be enforced, that governments should not use chemical weapons, banned chemical weapons, certainly against civilians. And previously, when this happened very early in Donald Trump's presidency, he enforced that red line with 59 cruise missiles and took great credit for enforcing a red line in a way that Barack Obama had not done. But before this chemical weapons attack, Donald Trump had signaled that actually he was losing interest in having any role whatsoever in the sort of quagmire in Syria. So what was going on in U.S.-Syria policy when this chemical weapons attack took place?
So U.S.-Syria policy is focused on defeating the Islamic State, which is this terrorist group that seized all kinds of huge swaths of territory in Iraq and Syria in 2014 after the Obama red line was crossed, and then he didn't really launch the military attack that he had threatened. So the U.S. policy is focused on defeating ISIS. ISIS is mostly defeated, is defeated in Iraq, and it's mostly defeated at this point in Syria. There's still a few pockets holding out. And the president said in a speech that, you know, the United States is going to be pulling out soon, that ISIS, that the job is almost done. The United States has also been saying that its overall objective in Syria, or goal in Syria, is to for there to be democracy and for the Syrian people to choose their own leaders. The problem is that there's no policy or strategy to make that happen.
Paul, let's explain to readers around the world, to listeners around the world, if they have a sort of sense that America sometimes has a very hawkish president who believes that America can change governments, can tell the world what to do, can use military force. Or sometimes America has more dovish, kind of peace-loving presidents who are reluctant to use force at all. Is there, in fact, with Donald Trump, a third sort of president, someone who is willing to use military force but actually has no real interest in there being a better government in Syria? Is that what we're looking at with Donald Trump? Explain to listeners around the world what sort of government America has right now and what sort of ambitions they might have to a country, towards a country like Syria.
First of all, let me add one thing to what Oren said. It's very important. The president has said that these kind of chemical weapons attacks are outrageous. I think everyone agrees that they indeed are. But why is he particularly outraged about this one? He launched the Tomahawk missile attack, as you say, about a year ago, 59 cruise missiles. But a think tank here in Washington, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, actually pointed out that in the past year there have been something like 20 other chemical weapons attacks as well. So why the outrage over this one? Perhaps he's looking for a distraction from domestic problems, just speculation. But to come back to your question, the president ran, as you know, on this strategy of kind of America lowering its profile around the world. America first. He wanted to focus on rebuilding our infrastructure, taking care of Americans who've been left behind, that kind of thing. Unfortunately, the realities in much of the world will not realistically allow a president to do that. In general, his overall philosophy, in my opinion, and I cover the White House, is that he would prefer not to be involved in these kind of foreign entanglements, but I think the realities of the world are such that he finds himself keep getting drawn back in.
Oren, if it was just a question of the Syrian regime, which is a very nasty but not a gigantically powerful regime, doing a wicked thing, and America sent ordering some warships in the Mediterranean to fire cruise missiles, on the face of it, that's not a very risky move. You know, the missiles just land and they do their damage and the message is sent. What are the other players in this kind of cauldron of war that might make America anxious, that we understand in the Pentagon, the top generals and leaders in the Pentagon have been saying, hang on, there are other countries involved in this that we could find ourselves in conflict with? What's going on?
So this is the thing with Syria, is that, first of all, I want to mention that this chemical attack was worse than all the others that have happened. And I counted with the UN 8 chemical attacks since Trump took office. But maybe there might have been more that were that they didn't catch. But the issue is that Syria is very, very complex. After the Obama red line incident, the Russians sent their air force into Syria, and they've been supporting Bashar Assad, and they've helped him regain control over much of the territory that he lost control of in his country. The Iranians have mobilized the Shiite, what they call mobilization forces, militias, from as far away as Afghanistan and Pakistan to Syria and to fight alongside Bashar Assad's military. They've also been supporting Hezbollah, which is a very powerful militia and political movement in Lebanon, and they're in Syria by the thousands.
And of those foreign forces, you have Russian airmen, Russian fighters, Russian air defense batteries with Russian troops, and then some Russian mercenaries.
Right. So the issue is that the Russians have threatened to retaliate, not only to shoot down, they have very advanced missile defense systems, and they've threatened to not only shoot down any missiles that come in, but also to attack wherever they came from. And the American military, the defense minister, Secretary Jim Mattis, is they want to prevent an escalation. They don't want to get into a war with Iran and Russia in Syria.
Paul Brandis, just sort of finally on this before we move to other subjects. We have seen other governments also keen to get involved. We've seen the French government, Emmanuel Macron, who's coming to Washington soon, the president of France, saying that there is proof that this is a chemical weapons attack, because obviously the Syrians deny it. You've seen the British government saying that they would like to join a coalition. How does that play at the United Nations? What's going on? I mean, Russia is siding with the Syrians, is saying it doesn't believe there is any evidence. How ugly is this getting sort of in the UN Security Council at the moment?
Well, the United States, through our ambassador there, Nikki Haley, has said that the UN needs to act on this. But it's important to point out, of course, that Russia has a permanent veto in the Security Council, which, of course, will limit any kind of substantive action. there. It's just interesting also that if you look at this seven-year civil war, I think now in its eighth year, I think something like 5% of the population has died. The UN, I think, has said something like two-fifths of the population has been displaced, and yet the Russians say, well, don't attack because it might destabilize the region. I think it's a bit too late for that. I don't see anything happening in the UN.
And obviously, the British and the French governments and some others, they are very clear in the UN. They say incredibly fierce things about Russia's covering for this wicked dictator in Syria. And actually, the American ambassador, as you say, Nikki Haley, also says very fierce things. But where does Donald Trump fit into that? Because he has been historically very reluctant to criticize President Vladimir Putin or even really to criticize Russia at all. Has that changed at all this week?
He has actually, I think to the surprise of a lot of foreign policy watchers, kind of changed his tune somewhat on Russia. It's quite interesting, of course, with the additional sanctions, the closing of a Russian consulate in Seattle in the American Northwest. And some of these sanctions, by the way, hit close to home in terms of some of his cronies and that kind of thing financially. So quite different than what than the sort of the Trump of a year ago. So the toughening up is quite interesting, a bit of a surprise.
And just before we go to the break, Oren, has Donald Trump broken now with Vladimir Putin, or is he still perhaps keener than his own team to maintain good relations with the Russian president?
Well, he's done all these things that Paul said, but at the same time, he also continues to, you know, he's criticized Putin. He's said on Twitter, you know, don't support this animal, as Trump puts it, Bashar Assad. But he's also still holding out the olive branch, trying to find a way to cooperate with Russia.
And of course, when you talk about Russia and Donald Trump in the same breath, that is then tied up with this intensely dirty story that we'll come to after the break. The whole investigation into whether Russia and the Trump campaign colluded to get Donald Trump elected in 2016.
Thanks for tuning in to Issues in the News on the Voice of America. A reminder that Issues in the News is available as a free podcast on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Oren Durrell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today. And Paul Brandis, White House Correspondent for West Wing Reports. Our moderator is David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist.
So we were talking about the fact that in today's Washington, when you mention U.S.-Russia relations, you're not just talking about the United Nations or foreign policy. You're also talking about the FBI. You're talking about raids on the president's private lawyer. You're talking about a furious argument within Congress about whether Russia colluded with the Trump campaign to get the president elected. It has been an extremely busy week this week. Obviously, it began with something we had never seen before, which is a phrase we say a lot in Washington right now, the FBI sending agents to go to the office and the residence of Donald Trump's longtime private lawyer in New York, Michael Cohen. Paul Brandis, what did the FBI and the lawyer's lawyer tell us was the reason for that raid?
Well, first of all, this was a very unusual situation, and it would not have happened unless the FBI had reason to think that Mr. Cohen had evidence that could be useful in this broader investigation that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, has been tasked with. It's a rather broad mandate, frankly. So the Cohen raid kind of falls under this umbrella. And what we've learned is that one thing that these FBI agents seized were, we found out earlier this week, was that Mr. Cohen apparently had a penchant for recording conversations with all sorts of people, which kind of sounds like echoes of Watergate and the Nixon tapes and so forth. What is on these tapes? Who was he recording? What does it say about possible financial activities? And part of this also is that Mr. Cohen also helping his boss, President Trump, kind of cover up Mr. Trump's private life, which I think everyone with a reasonable mind can agree is rather shady and sleazy, paying off of women who he has alleged to have affairs with. Trump denies them, it's fair to point out, but nevertheless, that is what they're looking at.
Oren Durrell, before we move to the Mueller investigation, so this was not a raid investigating Russia collusion as is. It was a raid because they believed they'd stumbled on probable evidence that Donald Trump's lawyer might have broken the law. And as far as we can tell from the press reporting, this is linked to things like alleged payment. Well, we know actually payments to women who say that they had sexual relations with Donald Trump and that were paid large amounts of money in the run-up to the election campaign in 2016. Given that, you know, we don't have adultery courts in America, why might it be illegal for the president's lawyer to have paid a woman to keep her quiet in the run-up to an election? What kind of laws can you break in that context? What might they be investigating?
Well, there are limits on... So a payment that's made on behalf of a political candidate is can be considered a campaign contribution. And there are limits on campaign contributions, and campaign contributions have to be reported.
So the theory is that if this was essentially a bit like running an ad on TV, they were trying to keep these women quiet to help them get elected president, if you decide that's campaign spending and it wasn't reported, or if the money came from someone foreign, which is not allowed in this country, it's that kind of law he might have broken?
Right. And I think that it's interesting to look at the types of things that were seized in this raid. And everything that Paul said is correct, but they were looking at these personal and business finances related to his New York taxi fleet. Apparently, this lawyer, you know, Cohen had a taxi fleet that he was managing, and also documents related to the Access Hollywood tapes, which is...
These were the famous tapes that came out during the election where he boasted about how he'd get away with anything with sort of women actresses.
And he talked about grabbing women in places where they shouldn't be. You know, and also the role of the National Enquirer in silencing, allegedly silencing these women who alleged to have had affairs with Donald Trump. I mean, some of this, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't even know if that's illegal or not. But it sounds it's really pretty damning just to hear about it.
Paul, you cover the White House. You work in the White House. Obviously, this is very dramatic news for Donald Trump's lawyer, who could find himself in a lot of legal trouble. We also know that this made Donald Trump very, very angry indeed, the fact that his lawyer was raided. He you know, interrupted his own Syria kind of press meeting with journalists to sort of rant about it. How does this feed into the broader question of the Mueller investigation and the special counsel and Donald Trump's relationship with his own Department of Justice? What do people fear that an angry Donald Trump could do next?
Well, this is an emotionally impulsive president who some people think is unstable, is prone to being erratic and in a position of leadership that is potentially a very dangerous thing to be. His own West Wing has seen a significant turmoil, people coming and going. Just this week, more officials left and that kind of thing. At the same time, he's dealing with some of the things that we've talked about in the prior segment. I mean,
and could he fire some people? I mean, who might he fire in this mood of rage?
Well, I think that he is desperate, I think is a fair word, to shut down this Mueller investigation. He's been warned even by members of his own political party, the Republican Party, that it would be foolish for him to do so. But we know that he's tried to do it at least on two prior occasions. I think the cat is out of the bag on that. He could move to get rid of Mueller. It would probably politically make things even worse for him.
Oren Durrell, it's actually literally quite hard, we think, for the president to fire the special counsel directly. He would have to maybe fire the person who is in charge of the special counsel, who's the number two at the Department of Justice. But in purely political terms, you know, if he fires enough people, if he works his way down the chain, as Richard Nixon once did, what is the check and the balance? What stops Donald Trump from doing that? Where do we go next?
So there was a bill introduced a bipartisan bill introduced in Congress this week that would protect the special counsel. The name is something like the Protect the Special Counsel Act or something like that, or bill. And basically it would require if anyone wants to fire a special counsel, the special counsel, that decision would have to be reviewed by a judge, and the special counsel would have 10 days to appeal or to respond to that decision, and it basically would make it a lot more difficult for the White House or for the president to go through that, even if he went through that process, to actually succeed in doing it.
So that's an example of the kind of thing that Congress could do if Congress was united and determined to rein Donald Trump in. And yeah, you're so right that came from four senators, two Democrats and two Republicans. But to get something to be a law in this country, you would need to point to the leaders of the Republican Party in Congress, and you would need to point not just to senators, but also to the other chamber of Congress, the House, full of members who see an interest in being as loudly pro-Trump as possible.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners this law is being discussed. Four senators would like it to be put up for a vote. Is it going to become a law?
Well, we'll have to see what happens. I don't make predictions.
Well, can I add one thing to that? Even if enough Republicans got on board in both the House and the Senate to pass such a law, people forget the president can veto the law if it came to his desk, as he would seem likely to. The question would be, would there be enough votes in both the House and the Senate to override such a veto? So all of this is quite speculative. Even if they could pass a bill, I think he would veto.
And it would take time for that process to happen. And I think that the president could move quicker to fire people than the law, than possibly the law would get to being passed. The issue, what I wanted to add to this, though, is that there's a report that the president is considering a pardon for Scooter Libby, who is a guy who was convicted in a previous case under the George W. Bush's presidency. But what's important about it is that it's seen that this move is seen as a signal to his to the president's associates to not turn on him in this investigation.
To remind people that he can pardon people, he has that power. Let's turn finally to another spectacle we saw on Capitol Hill this week, which was one of the world's richest men, one of the world's most powerful digital sort of tech barons, Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, was hauled before Congress to spend 2 days being grilled by first the Senate, then the House, about whether Facebook needs to change the way that its entire business works. Paul, how big a deal was this to have Mark Zuckerberg on Congress, on Capitol Hill?
Well, he was hauled before lawmakers, obviously, because of this the final straw, I think, was this huge breach by this company called Cambridge Analytica, which accessed personal data of tens of millions of people. Very embarrassing. The firm has ties to President Trump and that kind of thing. Just in a nutshell, Congress is good at two things. It's good at doing nothing, and it's good at doing too much. There's talk about possibly regulating Facebook, but the Republican Congress is not particularly inclined to regulations. I'm not quite sure anything is really going to happen.
Does Europe play a role in this? I mean, Europe is much more concerned about privacy and data in general. Facebook has plenty of users in Europe. Could America unusually find itself looking at the other side of the Atlantic to see what's happening there?
Well, apparently that's actually what's happening. They're looking at European laws that require Facebook to not collect certain information and to expunge or to erase certain other information. And that might be included in some of these regulations that are being considered.
Do you sense a sort of sea change in terms of views of tech in general? I mean, for a long time, tech barons came to Capitol Hill, were treated like gods who'd invented the future. Is there a kind of backlash that you can feel in the air, Paul, in Washington?
I do sense that, indeed. I think politically, a lot of these tech companies, which in the past have tended to be more favorable to Democratic administrations in terms of donating money and that kind of thing, I think their preference is to kind of wait these Republicans out, hope for perhaps a more politically friendly environment. But no question, I think they're on the defensive now.
And of course, you had libertarians in Silicon Valley. You had some big tech barons who actually supported Donald Trump because they're very much in favor of kind of very limited government. Is this a limited government libertarian moment, or do you think that actually we're into slightly more of a kind of government cracking down sort of feel to Washington right now?
Well, that's a big question. I'm not quite sure. I think that the data breach and other things like it in general have opened in years past sort of a Pandora's box that I think could lead to greater cracking down, I think, in more efforts to protect the privacy of Americans in general. It's not necessarily Facebook, but the broader issues of cyber hacking and breaches, that kind of thing.
That's all the time we have. Thanks to Oren Durell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for West Wing Reports. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And For the last time, as I'm off to Asia for a few years, I'm David Rennie of The Economist.